Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, and I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. And Carrie is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Fred Feldman. Fred is professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His new book is titled Distributive Justice, Getting What We Deserve from Our Country. And it's published by Oxford University Press. It's a fantastic book. And in it, Fred resuscitates and revises a view of distributive justice that for a long time, most political philosophers had considered debunked or moribund or in some other way debilitated. To be more specific, Fred has proposed an original and I think quite sturdy version of desertism about distributive justice. Now, speaking very roughly, desertism is the view according to which justice prevails in a society when all of its members get what they deserve, in some sense of that phrase, from whatever entity has the job of enacting justice. Now, that's entirely too sketchy, of course. And as we'll see, I think in the conversation to come, sort of removing some of the sketchiness and getting more precise is really the task for the desertist and Professor Feldman's main task in the book. So on the other hand, we might say desertism, even in the sketchy form, seems so obviously correct as to not need a theory. After all, what could be more simple? What else could justice be but a state of affairs where everyone gets her due? Again, as Feldman shows, things aren't simple with desertism. A lot of nuance is required. He's in the business in this book of providing the necessary nuance and providing all the details that would be required to reveal desertism to be a formidable view a formidable view about distributive justice. So as I've just indicated, there's a whole lot to talk about. And I highly recommend Fred Feldman's book to anyone who's interested in political philosophy and certainly to anyone who works on distributive justice. But before we get into the details and the specifics of Feldman's argument, we usually begin these podcasts by greeting our guests. So let me do that. Hello, Fred.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks very much for having me. It's really a pleasure to have this chance to talk about the book.
Well, it's wonderful of you to be generous with your time and to appear on the program. As I just was talking, I'm sure I haven't said anything you disagree with yet. Desertism is a very nuanced view, and your book introduces a lot of the required nuance, it seems to me. But why don't we start off by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Well, I was born in Newark, New Jersey, and I grew up in Maplewood, New Jersey. And my best friend was a guy named Jack who lived across the street. He was a little older than me. And he had gone off to the University of Pennsylvania, and I was still stuck in high school. And he came back, and I said, "Well, what did you learn? What were you doing there?" And he told me this wonderful story about something that happened in his introduction to philosophy class, and it had to do with Descartes. And the teacher said that Descartes had said, "I think, therefore I exist." And under the circumstances, Descartes was trying to find the first truth that comes to a person who reasons in an orderly way. And the first truth was that he existed. And I thought, that's really wonderful. Wow, the first truth, I exist. And then my friend Jack said to me, well, actually, we also learned that Bertrand Russell had shown that this whole thing was completely hopeless because the premise, I think, already presupposed the existence of the self, I, and that Descartes had no justification for saying, I think if he was starting from scratch, he should have said, well, there's some thinking going on here. And from that premise, he could never derive the conclusion that he exists. So he would have been stuck if he had done it in a better way. And I said, well, now that's really neat. I would love to take classes about that kind of stuff. I thought that was wonderful. And time came for me to go to college, and I thought I was a very cocky guy, and I applied only to one college, a little college down near Philadelphia, and I didn't get in. And I couldn't believe it. I said, how is this possible? I'm so wonderful. Why wouldn't they let me in? And my guidance advisor said, well, you know, they have a quota for Jews, and probably there were several Jews who are smarter than you.
Oh,
and so I was really stuck. And as a result of that, I ended up in a different college where they didn't do much philosophy. And as a result of that, my start in graduate school was delayed. And I really messed up there. I made a stupid decision, and it set me back probably by 5 years. But eventually I ended up at Brown, where my teacher was Roderick Chisholm. And other people who were there were Ernie Souza and Jagwon Kim and Herbert Heidelberger, all friends of mine, and some wonderful graduate students. And I thought it was just fabulous. I thought it was heaven on earth, Providence, Rhode Island. And I did a dissertation mainly in metaphysics about identity with Chisholm. And I went off to Chicago Circle for my first job with Ruth Marcus, and that was great. But I didn't like Chicago, and I had an opportunity to come to UMass in 1969. But I had to agree at that time that I would do history of philosophy. So I was mainly doing stuff about Descartes and Leibniz and Locke. And then as a result of some personal interactions with one of my colleagues, I ended up teaching ethics. And I was interested in deontic logic, and I was in utilitarianism, and I wrote a book about that, and I was very interested in that. And I was doing ethics. But then my daughter, our first child, came down with a serious illness, a form of cancer, and she had to undergo a lot of surgery, and it was really terrible. And eventually she died. Oh. And I wrote a book about death, Confrontations with the Reaper. And I was interested in philosophical problems about the nature and the badness of death. And I went around giving talks in various places. And I was always talking about death. And my view about the evil of death was that the badness of a person's death for the person is determined by the goodness of the for the person of the life that's thereby lost. Mm. You know, the deprivation view.
Right.
And people ask a lot of questions about that. Isn't my view a view about the difference in the welfare that a person actually enjoys and the welfare that the person would have enjoyed if the person hadn't died? And that was right. And so I had to come up with a view about what makes for welfare. And after thinking about it for a while, I came up with the idea that a person's welfare is not simply a matter of the amounts of pleasure and pain that the person enjoys and suffers, but adjusted for desert. I got interested in desert because I was interested in desert-adjusted welfare. Mm-hmm. And I made use of that idea also in a utilitarian theory, desert-adjusted utilitarian, hedonistic utilitarian theory. And then as I got along, I thought I was interested in justice because I thought that my utilitarian idea was the idea that an act is right if it maximizes utility adjusted for justice. And so I had to come up with some view about justice. And so I came up with a confused idea about justice, and I published some papers about that, and they were really mixed up, very confused. I'm sort of embarrassed about them. But then when I got older and I was almost ready to retire, and some of my students asked me to teach a class about justice, I did. And then I worked it up into this book. It took me a while and didn't get published until after I was retired. But that's where the book about justice came from and how it fits into my personal confused passage through various colleges.
Well, it's a worthy contribution in any case. Why don't we turn to talking about the contents of the book? Would that be okay?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. So, I like to begin these conversations with questions about the author's methodology or the approach or how the author understands the philosophical or maybe the metaphilosophical commitments going into the inquiry. So I want to begin with a question about where your book begins, because it does begin by raising a couple of methodological and sort of conceptual observations about the field in which political philosophy in which people theorize justice. So you open with what looked to me like some very well-considered remarks about the sheer variety of things that philosophers set about theorizing under the banner of justice. For some, justice is a virtue of institutions or states. For others, justice is another name for the entirety of virtue. Some theorize justice, proposing views about what ought to be done, you say. In other cases, people who are theorizing justice are proposing views about how some specific groups of people should act. While there are others that are interested in identifying the social conditions that are such that were they to prevail, it would be correct to call that society just. So I wanted to just ask you to begin by sort of running us through some of this sort of what we might call sort of the sort of conceptual housekeeping that the book begins with.
Okay, fine. I had originally wanted to have a big quotation from G.E. Moore at the beginning of the book, but Cambridge University Press wouldn't allow me to quote such a long passage from the preface to Principia Ethica. And Moore says there, and here I'm reading this off a sheet of paper, "It appears to me that in ethics, as in all other philosophical studies, the difficulties and disagreements of which its history is full are mainly due to a very simple cause, namely to the attempt to answer questions without first discovering precisely what question it is which you desire to answer." I think that's just a wonderful insight that Moore had there. And I think it's something that philosophers have been guilty of not taking into consideration. They launch into a discussion of answers to a question before they've slowed up enough to think about what question it is that they mean to be answering. This has a special impact on discussions of justice. If you look into standard encyclopedia articles about distributive justice, you'll regularly see that the author says, well, there are several main philosophers who have been talking about justice, and they say Rawls, Nozick, Parfit, Frankfurt. They say, you know, there's the difference principle, and there's prioritarianism, and there's sufficientism, and there's egalitarianism, and these are all theories of justice. But it seems to me that if you look more closely at the actual words of the philosophers that they're talking about there, in many cases, it's not clear that they're talking about justice at all. Hmm. That they're offering a theory about some other thing. This comes out in the case of, it's strikingly in the case of Rawls, because Rawls, you know, the book is entitled A Theory of Justice, and he's, everybody thinks he's given a theory of justice. But I was just amazed when I looked toward the back end of his book, and he's describing what people in the original position would be, what theories that they would be talking about and weighing, which should be the theory of justice for our society. And one says, well, egoism, we should go for egoism. And Rawls distinguishes a couple of different kinds of egoism. And then another person says, well, sufficientism. Another says the theory of prima facie duties. Another says utilitarianism. Another says, you know, and you say, why would people in the original position be talking about all these theories in the normative ethics of behavior? Why would they be talking about the prima facie duties? Why would they be talking about egoism if they're supposed to be coming up with a theory of justice? And it struck me that Rawls was really completely confused about whether he was talking about what people ought to do, what our moral obligations are, or whether he was talking about what justice requires. And amazingly enough, I found a passage in a later book by Rawls in which he comes right out and says, boy, when I wrote A Theory of Justice, I was just confusedly ramming together the normative ethics of behavior, about how we ought to behave, and political philosophy, what would be just. And he says, this is in a book about liberalism, he says now he sees that those are different questions. Now he just wants to talk about political philosophy. And if you look at Parfit, for example, in a paper that's supposed to be about his theory of justice, he distinguishes two different kinds of prioritarianism. And one is a theory about what would be bad. It's bad for people to get, what he's describing egalitarianism. It's bad when people get less than others through no fault of their own. That seems like axiology, a theory of value about what would be bad. And then he says, and then there's a deontic form of it, which says we should arrange things so that people don't get less than others. Now, that's a theory. It looks to me like a theory in normative ethics, and neither one of them is a theory of justice. And I think, you know, Harry Frankfurt has this paper about sufficientism, and he says what's morally important is not equality. What's morally important is that everybody should get enough. And the word justice doesn't even appear in the article.
Right.
He's talking about what's morally important. And other people talk about theories of justice. They're alleged to be talking about theories of justice. And they say, this is what we seek. This is what we aim for. This is what we want. They never say that this is what would be most just. So it seems to me that there's really, it's tremendously important at the outset of any such discussion that we should really make it very clear, if we're trying to present a theory of justice, that that's our target. The target is distributive justice. That's what we're aiming to present a theory about. And then we run into this really bizarre situation where, with respect to the most important contributors to the literature, it becomes unclear whether they were really trying to give an answer to the question, what makes for distributive justice in a state? They could be trying to present some theory about some other topic. And so I'm in an awkward position in the book where I want to criticize these theories, and the theories are associated with certain famous philosophers, and yet it's not clear to me that these philosophers were actually presenting theories about the topic that's normally said to be their topic. So I think we have to identify the target, right? Distributive justice.
Right. And so the part of the awkwardness that you're mentioning, and one of the things that you are very judicious, I think, in doing in the book is trying very carefully to formulate the leading conceptions in the literature of justice as trying to formulate them in a way that makes them even philosophically comparable. Right.
That's exactly right. Yes.
So that it's able to say, you know, the Rawlsian view says this, the priority view or the sufficiency view says this, my view says this. And in each case, we're getting a formulation that starts roughly with the same kind of, that has the same, we might say, logical structure. A society is perfectly just if and only if. And then you fill in a blank. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. But then I'm in a strange position where if Rawls could speak up and defend himself, he might say, wow, that's a nice criticism of this view that you have written down in your book. But I never said that. And Parfit, if he could speak up, might say, well, that's a nice view, a nice criticism of that view. But I never said that. You know, if you look at my book, I never said that. And of course, Frankfurt could say that the view that I criticize is not the view that he had actually stated. He stated a view about moral importance, and I don't state any view about moral importance. So I'm in an awkward position of criticizing views and mentioning the names of certain philosophers, and it's not really clear to me that I can pin these views on the philosophers to whom they're normally attributed.
It is an awkward position to be in. And you know, let's not pass over the further kind of awkwardness where one might have the following thought, right? That debates over justice have been the most vibrant, active sites within political philosophy for 60 years now. It would be a scandal, one more scandal to philosophy, if it were to turn out that the purported main contenders in these debates are not even conceptions of the same thing.
Yeah. Doesn't that make Moore's remark ever more important? It appears to me that in ethics, the difficulties and disagreements of which its history is full are mainly due to a very simple cause, namely the attempt to answer questions without discovering precisely what question it is which you desire to answer.
Yeah, that seems right.
If people have been trying to answer different questions, no wonder they have come up with different answers.
And again, this also might explain the seeming interminability of some of the debates, right?
Yes.
So that's all very helpful. So your view then is offered as an attempt, both to provide a desertist conception of distributive justice and to display its relative merits to competitors, judiciously formulated as proper competitors, we can say. And that is that you take that when we're setting about to theorize distributive political economic justice, we are interested in specifying the conditions under which, the social conditions under which, it would be correct to call a society just. Is that right? Is that how you understand the target question?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Why don't we, again, folks, the methodological stuff with which Fred begins is I think really, really quite well done and very, very interesting. But let's move on to the theory. Would that be?
No.
Oh, good.
No,
oh, say more.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to move on to the theory until I say a little bit more about what it's supposed to be a theory about.
Good. Yes, please continue.
It seems to me that there's many different virtues or excellences that a state could have. Such things as having great scientists or artists or athletes, and being a great world power, or being able to help out poor people who are suffering from hurricanes or tornadoes, having great foreign policy. You know, there's all kinds of virtues that a state can have. Among the virtues that a state can have is one that concerns how the state goes about distributing certain benefits and burdens among its own citizens. Now, it seems to me that there are certain things, and different theories of justice are going to have different views about what these things are, but certain things that it seems quite natural to say that it's part of the business of a government to see to it that these things are distributed among the citizens in a fair way. Things like the benefits and burdens that states can distribute, the right to vote, or the right, or the duty to serve in the army, or the right to having a subsidy to help you go to pay your college tuition if you go to a state college, or health care. These are things, you know, the opportunity to have health insurance. These are things that it naturally falls to a state to see to or ensure a good distribution among the citizens. There's debate about what precisely those things are, so let's just call them the currency of justice, mm-hmm. The things such that it falls to a state to ensure that they're well distributed among its citizens. Different theories of justice, then, are going to have different views about what the currency of justice is. Now, I want to understand distributive justice, that's my target, as the virtue that a state has if it does a really excellent job of distributing the currency of justice among its citizens. So if that's right, then there's lots of things that people could complain about in a country without complaining about distributive justice. So somebody could say, well, the United States, this is terrible. Our ping pong team has never done very well in the Olympics. I think we should have a better Olympic team. Or somebody could say, oh, I'm really disappointed with the United States. This is terrible. There's all these disasters going on in Africa, and poverty and illness, and we're not doing enough to help those people out. We should do more. Or somebody could say, we haven't done enough to make foreign governments recognize the importance of ensuring the civil rights of their citizens. You know, we should do more on that front. We could have all these complaints about our government. None of them is a complaint about distributive justice, as I'm conceiving it, because none of them focuses on the way in which the currency of justice is being distributed among citizens of this country. So I'm not saying that justice is being a great state or being excellent in all the ways in which a state could be excellent. Justice, is, as I'm conceiving of it, is much more narrow than that. It's simply doing an excellent job of ensuring that the currency of justice is well distributed among the citizens. So that's the topic that I want to talk about. And it's not clear to me that people who write on justice always have that particular target in mind. And if not, well, then they're talking about something different from what I'm talking about.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Excellent. Do we want to get into the desertism at this point? Would that be good?
Well, yes. In a preliminary way, say something about some answers that have been given to this question. That'll provide a sort of spot where I can say what my view is. Okay.
Yeah. Let's do that.
So suppose somebody, here's an egalitarian view, and people have actually defended this view. They might say there's perfect justice in a country if the currency of justice is distributed equally among the citizens. Now, if you combine that with the view that the currency of justice is wealth, then you have a kind of egalitarianism of wealth that says you have distributive justice in a country, perfect justice, if wealth is distributed equally. Now, a sufficientist view would say they might agree about the currency of justice. They might say it's wealth, but they might say, no, equality is not what makes for justice. It's that everybody should have a sufficient amount. And so that view would say we have perfect distributive justice in a country if every citizen of that country, the government sees to it that every citizen of that country has at least a sufficient amount of wealth. And you might have a Rawlsian difference principle type view if you were to say we have perfect justice in a country if the government sees to it that the people in the worst off class with respect to primary social goods, which they take to be the currency of justice, everybody in the worst off class has the largest feasible share of primary social goods. So those are some possible views. And my view then would be the view that all of those are mistaken. And the real truth is that you have perfect distributive justice in a country if the currency of justice is distributed according to desert. That is, if each citizen of the country gets a share of the currency of justice in accord with the amount that he deserves. And I also want to add to that, that where we have imperfect justice in a country, we can measure the approximation that that distribution has to a perfect distribution. And then we can say that one country is more distributively just than another, provided that the way that the currency of justice is distributed more closely approximates a perfect distribution, which would be in accord with desert. So that's the view.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, that's excellent. So, okay. Yeah. Now, there are lots of varieties of desertism, though. So there are that statement that you've just offered of what the view is doesn't disambiguate your particular articulation of desertism from others that are in currency, because we still have to ask the question, what's desert? Can you help us a little bit on that?
Yes.
Good. I figured you would be able
to. Well, I think I can help. I'm not so sure. Maybe some people will not be helped by what I say. I think that the concept of desert is familiar. We talk about desert all the time. You say a student deserves to get a high grade because the student produced good work. Or we say that a criminal deserves a long jail sentence because he committed such a terrible crime or he's been found guilty of it. We can say, as Bill and Melinda Gates did, that everybody deserves the chance to what was their thing? A healthful or healthy and something or other life. We talk about desert all the time. Somebody steps on my toe and I look over at him and I feel I deserve an apology from this guy. He just stepped on my toe. Or if you receive a nice gift from somebody and you person might feel that they deserve a thank you note. Mm-hmm. Dessert is very common, and philosophers make use of the concept of dessert more technically in lots of different contexts, thinking that there's this Kantian idea that happiness is a great good, but especially if the person who receives it deserves to have it. Mm-hmm. So it's important to be clear about what specific form of dessert I'm talking about. One thing about dessert claims is that when somebody deserves something, there has to be some basis upon which the person deserves it. You can't just deserve something for no reason at all. There's got to be some basis for dessert. Sometimes when people talk about dessert, they have in mind the case in which you deserve something because you've been virtuous or morally excellent or good. And I want to distinguish that from the sort of dessert that I'm talking about, that I would want to call moral merit. Mm-hmm. And say, yeah, there's such a thing as dessert based upon moral virtue. Let's call that moral merit. Then there's dessert just based upon the fact that you're a human being. You know, we might think that you deserve a certain amount of respect just because you're a human being. All these different kinds of, all these different sorts of dessert, that's different from what I have in mind. What I have in mind is political economic dessert, things that you deserve from your country in virtue of the fact that you're a citizen of that country, that you need these things in order to flourish as a human being, and you can't get them without being a member of a civilized community. And I think that the things that you deserve in that way are such things as, this is the Hobbesian element in the theory, mm-hmm. such things as security, so that you deserve to live in a country where the government or some agency of the government or somebody overseen by the government will see to your security, either with an army or with a police force or with the National Guard or with a militia or with somebody is going to help you out. And that's because you need to have security in order to flourish as a human being. And no individual, well, very few individuals, have the power to guarantee their own security. Maybe we have a counterexample to that nowadays, but most of us are not capable of putting together defense forces that would be strong enough to protect us from foreign or local attacks. Mm-hmm. We need to have a police force, somebody that we can turn to in times of need for security. I think that part of what we deserve from our country, among our political economic desserts, are security. That's the Hobbesian element. Then there's an element that I got from Obama, the Obamian element, and that is a need for opportunity. There's things that we need in order to develop and grow and flourish that we're not able to provide without being embedded in a community. And I have in mind here such things as an educational system, a banking system, nowadays the internet, the interstate highway system, the judicial system, all these things that when they are in place and they're available, they make it possible for us to grow and flourish and develop our abilities and reach our potentials or get closer to our potentials in various areas, business, academics, sports, arts, that we otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So I think that those are more political economic desserts, other things that we deserve in the relevant political economic way. And then I think there's some entitlements, some legal entitlements. I think under certain circumstances, the fact that you're legally entitled to something makes you deserve, in my way, to get that thing. For an example, suppose that you filed your income tax in accord with the regulations, and suppose they're reasonable regulations, and suppose that after all is said and done, it turns out that the government has, the IRS has taken more in withholding tax from you than you actually owe them, according to the income tax, and you are entitled to a certain refund. Now I think that you, if the conditions are satisfied, that you deserve to get your refund. And I think that your desert of that refund counts as a political economic desert, because you're entitled to it by the regulations of an institution that is a reasonable, sensible institution that's been properly established in your country. Then I think that you can get desert because you have political economic desert because of that entitlement. So there's the three features: need for security, the need for opportunity, and a legitimate entitlement that yield political economic deserts on those specified bases. And so now I can say on my form of desertism, we have justice in a country, political economic justice, if the citizens of the country receive the political economic deserts that they deserve from the government on the basis of their political economic desert basis. So that's my view.
And the perfect. And these desert bases, the bases for desert are tied to these sort of needs for human flourishing that would not be available to individuals, but for a well-functioning community. Is that right?
That's right. This is a kind of Aristotelian idea. Right.
That's what I was trying to bring out. Yeah.
I take it that we have community essential needs. That I don't think Aristotle used precisely that terminology, but I get the idea from him. That is, things that we need in order to flourish as human beings, but things that no individual would be able to guarantee to himself without being embedded in a community that gathers together to provide them for him or her. So those things are community essential needs, and many of the features of my conception of justice is based upon that. It's the assurance of these things that makes for justice in a country.
Excellent. And so just let's draw out a couple of the contrasts that that we've already touched upon that are even implicit, maybe even obvious, now that your version of desertism is on the table. So one set of contrasts, I guess, involves the contrast between your version of desertism and the moral merit kinds of conceptions of desertism. So your invocation of political desert bases looks like, and the community, the communal needs stuff, we're not, as desertists on the Feldman view, we're not in the business of assessing anyone's overall moral merit as a way of determining their desert. Is that right?
That's right. I have a nice example that's supposed to illustrate the difference between desert and moral merit. It's a little tricky case. Suppose we have two brothers, identical twin brothers, and suppose that they earn the same amount of money and they have the same number of dependents, and they file the same income tax, and they get the same size return of the excess that they paid. Each gets a check from the government for a certain amount of money. Suppose it turns out that one of these twin brothers is a very nice person, really a morally upstanding person, the person who keeps his promises and he pays his debts and he is kind and he does volunteer work. And he's really a very nice guy, a very pleasant, decent person, an admirable person with lot of virtue. And I suppose the other twin brother has turned out just the reverse. He's a nasty person. He's just a very unpleasant guy. He's rude to people, and he sometimes breaks his promises to his family members and so on. Now, one of them is more morally meritorious than the other. Because one of them is a more virtuous person than the other. And yet they got the same size income tax refund. Now, if we had a theory that says that justice obtains when people get the benefits that they deserve on the basis of their moral merit, we'd have to say there's an injustice here, that the state is to blame, that somehow if there were an external justice review board looking down on this situation in this country, they would have to say, whoa, wait a minute. There's an injustice going on here. The nasty twin is getting just as big an income tax return refund as the morally virtuous twin. I'm inclined to say no. That isn't the business of government to check to see about the moral virtue of people who have filed their income taxes. It's their duty to return the money in accord with the regulations that the IRS has been following. And if the two brothers are alike with respect to income, and they're alike with respect to withholdings, they're alike with respect to dependents and so on, then they're entitled to equal refunds. And justice has been done if they get what they deserve on the basis of their political economic deserts, not on the basis of their moral merit. So I think those are different ideas.
Right, of course.
And I think that, yes.
No, you can continue, please.
Well, I wanted to say it's also important to distinguish between desert, as I'm using the term, and entitlement.
Right.
A person could be entitled to something that he doesn't deserve, and he could deserve something that he's not entitled to, and another twin brother case is going to establish that, or constitute my argument for it anyway. That is, suppose we have a grandfather who has some great wealth, and he has two grandsons, and the grandsons, one is a very nasty person, a terrible person, and just has treated the grandfather very rudely, insulted the grandfather, never took him to his medical appointments, never sat up with him while he was dying. The other grandson had been very kind to the grandfather, always behaved very respectfully, did drive him to his medical appointments, and so on. And suppose the grandfather, for some reason, decides to leave his money to the nasty grandson and not to the virtuous, excellent grandson. You know, we might say the virtuous grandson, the nice grandson, this is not political economic desert, but he morally deserves, he has desert of some of the estate, but he isn't entitled to it. And he isn't entitled to it because, in accordance with all the existing rules and regulations, the grandfather gave it to the other grandson. And so if no rules have been broken, no laws have been broken, then the nasty son is entitled but doesn't deserve the money. And the virtuous grandson does deserve the money, but he isn't entitled. So entitlement is a different idea from desert. My theory is a theory about desert, but it's not about moral desert. It's a theory about political economic desert. Desert based upon community essential needs.
Excellent.
Okay?
Yeah, that disambiguates your version of desertism from others, and particularly the ones that are often the targets of philosophers' critiques, which we'll get to in a moment. Can we just very quickly, if we're able, sort of draw or punctuate the distinctions between your version of desertism and some run-of-the-mill garden variety versions of egalitarianism and the sufficiency view? So it looks as if your version of desertism would allow for certain inequalities that a perfectly just society could involve, perhaps even considerable disparities. Is that right? Among whatever it is that justice is in the business of distributing.
Correct. That's exactly right. Yes.
And in that respect, it's not an egalitarian view, or it's distinguished from an egalitarian view.
Right. Now, it would be a very extreme sort of egalitarian who would say such a thing as this, but we can imagine a form of egalitarianism that says you have perfect justice in a state if the currency of justice is distributed equally among the citizens.
Right.
And my view, corresponding view, would be you have perfect justice in a state if the currency of justice is distributed to the citizens of the state in accordance with their desert of it. Now, you can imagine a country in which some of the people are, lazy, worthless, non-contributing, non-volunteering, drug-addicted, sleazy. I'm about to use some terminology that would be too heavily loaded. I want to be careful of this. But people who really, we look at them and we say, boy, this guy, he's just mooching off the state. He's taking advantage of his welfare check every month just to buy more drugs. And he has never done anything for his fellow citizens. And imagine a class of people like that. And then there's a class of excellent people who work very hard and make a lot of contributions and do a lot. And if we had the egalitarian view that everybody deserves an equal share of political, economic, everybody deserves an equal share of the currency of justice, then we would have to imagine a situation in which every month when it comes time for the checks to be distributed, that the lazy, worthless bums would get a check big enough to bring them up to the equalized average. And the wonderful, kind-hearted volunteers would get a notice saying they owe more money because their money has to be transferred to the lazy bums. Now, if egalitarianism is taken very seriously as the view that we have justice only if all citizens get equal shares of the currency of justice, then we'd have to say in a case like that, that justice requires that bits of the currency of justice should be taken away from the more deserving people and should be given to the less deserving people, which strikes me as being very impossible. I could use some different terminology there, but I don't want to be on record using harsh terminology. it seems to me that it's just very implausible. And I think the natural reaction to that would be to say, the problem here is that some of these people don't deserve to be equalized upwards, and some of these people don't deserve to be equalized downwards. The good people deserve to have more, and the worthless, unvirtuous people deserve to have less. So desertism would evaluate that case much better than a very extreme form of egalitarianism would.
Right, and I take it that the aim of a lot of more sophisticated versions of egalitarianism is to guard the view against those kinds of worries about patterns of distribution that look like they're so far out of whack with plausible conceptions of what people deserve.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think this is a point that I find tremendously interesting. We can imagine somebody starting out as a desertist, thinking that justice requires that people get what they deserve. And then having the person think, all people deserve equally. Having this egalitarian insight, all people deserve equal. And so we have justice when everybody gets an equal share. So, that shows a kind of priority of desertism, but it also points up the difficulty with the view, which is the egalitarianism of desert. It just doesn't seem to me to be true that all people are equally deserving. It seems to me that some people deserve more than others, depending upon what they've done. If somebody has been a brilliant entrepreneur. He's come up with a wonderful idea, a new drug, or a car that runs on water, or something. He makes a lot of money for that. Well, goodness, he deserves more than somebody who has contributed nothing. So it seems to me that egalitarianism can be seen as a kind of distorted form of desertism. It's distorted because it relies upon the assumption that everybody deserves just as much as everybody else. It seems to me that we don't all deserve the same amount. We certainly don't. We don't want to say that all our students deserve the same grade.
That seems right.
Or that everybody deserves to spend the same amount of time in the penitentiary. Right. You know, some people don't deserve to spend any time there, and other people, unfortunately, deserve to spend some time there. So there would be egalitarianism. Now we can think of another respect in which egalitarianism seems to run into trouble that my view doesn't run into trouble. One of the greatest objections to egalitarianism of the sort that I just described is the leveling down objection that came from Parfit.
Right.
That is, if you have a society in which some people are wealthy and some people are poor, and we think that the currency of justice is wealth, then we think, well, this would be a move toward justice if we could get these people all to be equal, if they had equal shares of the currency of justice. Now, if we have that intuition that a move toward equality would be a move toward greater justice, then, as Parfit pointed out, it wouldn't matter whether we equalized at the higher level or whether we equalized at the lower level, because either one of them would be a move toward equalization. And if egalitarianism were true, it would be a move toward greater justice. But I think you can see that moving toward equality at the lower level, you know, just taking money away from the richer people, assuming that that's the currency of justice, and just say burning it, might result in a situation in which we had an equal distribution, but it's preposterous to suppose that that would yield a greater level of distributive justice in the country. A much better idea would be to say that we would get a greater level of justice in the country if we saw to it that the distribution of the currency were in accord with desert, not just that it's equal. In one strange case, an equal distribution might be required by justice. That would be the case where people were, in fact, equally deserving. But in the real world, that doesn't happen very often.
But so let me ask one sort of quick clarifying question. Are there, on your view, vast differences among people's levels or among people's community essential needs as such?
Among community essential needs, I think some of them were going to differ and some of them are not going to differ very much. That is, the need to have an army and a police force to secure you, that's pretty much going to be the same for all of us. Now, maybe a tremendously wealthy person can afford to have his own bodyguards and he doesn't need to have the Secret Service provide bodyguards for him. But I'm just imagining a possible person. It could be a person like that.
Right.
But when you turn to something like health care, I think there you see a case in which people have different levels of need. Some very healthy people, you know, they might get along pretty well for quite a long time without having much health insurance, whereas some other people, they come into the world already being tremendously needy. They really have great needs for health insurance and health care. And though everybody is alike in this respect, everybody or all people are alike in this respect, they all need to have the community provide somehow for their health care in case of need. But since people's needs differ so much, some people deserve to get a lot of health care from the government or the government to ensure that they get that health care somewhere, either from private insurance or from a single payer or from from generous hospitals. So they deserve to get it from somebody. And other people don't really need all that much. And a similar thing happens with education. And a similar thing happens with respect to such things as interstate highways and sewer systems. You know, I don't get my water is not delivered in a pipe to my house. I have my own well. So I'm okay on that front. But if a flood should come through here and destroy my property and I need to be restored, then I would have greater needs. So people have all different size needs. And my claim is that we'd have perfect justice if all these political, economic desserts were satisfied.
I see. So let me just try to articulate the main contrast between your version of dessertism and then a standard sufficiency view. So let me know if this is right. So the sufficiency view, I take it from the Fred Feldman version of dessertism, the sufficiency view is inadequate because it doesn't recognize the possibility of a society's being unjust, even under conditions where everyone has enough, but people are getting less than what they deserve.
Yes, and I have an example in the book that's supposed to illustrate this in a kind of striking way. That is, I imagine a case in which we have some wealthy people and some middle class people, and we have some poor people who are doing badly, and they're doing so badly that they fall below their sufficiency level. And it's necessary that some of the currency of justice be redistributed from the wealthy people to the poor people. Now, suppose among the wealthy people, there's some who are blue and some who are green. Very wealthy people, some blue, some green. Suppose the government then says, okay, we're going to take all this money from the green people and give it to the poor people to get them up to their sufficiency level. But we're not going to take anything away from the equally wealthy blue people to give to the people who are under their thresholds. And suppose the system works. That is, roughly speaking, by discriminating, what did I say, the green people?
Yeah.
By discriminating against them and taking their money, we get everybody up above the sufficiency level. Now, a straightforward version of sufficientism says we have perfect justice if everybody is above the sufficiency level. On this arrangement, everybody has been brought above the sufficiency level. But it seems to me that it would have been done in a very unjust way. That is, by discriminating on the basis of color among the rich people to see who's going to supply the money to get the poor people up above their thresholds.
Right.
A much better way of doing it would be to tax all the rich people an equal amount, regardless of their color, so as to help to support the worst off people and get them above their sufficiency level. But sufficientism doesn't say anything about how people above the sufficiency level are to be treated. It just says that we have justice when everybody is up to their threshold or above. And that seems to me to be wrong. Now, I also think that sometimes there are people who've been so rotten and they behave so badly and they violated the laws so much that they don't deserve to be up to their sufficiency level. Imagine a bunch of really horrible criminals who've drug dealers, murdering gang members and innocent people and committing all these terrible crimes. And suppose they have been found guilty in a court of law and they've been sentenced to a long time in a unpleasant prison. And they're in the prison and they come forward and they say, I'm not up to my sufficiency level. I'm not getting enough money and leisure time activities and whatever else it is that they think that they would like to have in order to have reached a point at which I think that getting more of these things wouldn't make me any happier. That's Frankfurt's characterization. Well, that I would be prepared to say, yeah, they're below their sufficiency level. They haven't got so much that getting more couldn't make them happier. But I don't think there's any injustice there because I think they don't deserve to be up to their sufficiency level. So I just completely reject the idea that we have justice when everybody is brought up to the sufficiency level. I think some people deserve to be below the sufficiency level. And I think that even among people who are above the sufficiency level, there's ways of treating them which in some cases would be violations of the requirements of justice.
Right. Excellent. So I want to sort of move on to a sort of final question, if I may. You know, let me just note to our listeners that we're only scratching the surface in this interview. There's a lot of detail that we're sort of skipping over, and also I'm afraid just for time constraint reasons, we're not able to get to a very fascinating discussion in Fred's book about the priority view, which Fred raises questions about, and even raises the question of whether it, at the end of the day, is even a conception of justice at all, rather than some other kind of conception. But since we're nearing an hour for the interview, let me just ask Fred if I may, sort of one sort of big picture-y kind of question. Why do you think it's why do you think desertism has had the kind of we might say less than fully why hasn't desertism gotten its due? Let's put it that way. in discussions about distributive justice over the past couple decades, do you have any thoughts about about that?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I do have some thoughts about it. And one thought that I have about it is this. People going back to Leibniz and to Mill and to others, who Sidgwick and others who talked about justice as desert, when they talked about desert, they were always thinking of moral merit. And the idea that comes that stands out then as desertism is the idea that the state should see to it that the currency of justice is distributed in accord with moral merit. That just doesn't seem right. It just seems like a nutty idea. And it seems like a nutty idea for a variety of reasons, some of which were brought out by Rawls. Now, my form of desertism it doesn't say that we have justice when you have distributions in accord with moral merit, because I'm not making use of moral merit as the desert base upon which people deserve their share of the currency of justice. I'm making out the idea, developing the idea that the desert basis for getting your share of the currency of justice is political economic deserts, which are the kinds of needs that I described earlier. So I think part of the problem is that when people thought of desertism, they always thought of this moralistic happiness in heaven, suffering in hell version of desertism. And it is a pretty implausible view. And so people didn't buy into desertism because they didn't recognize that there were other options for desertism. And I think the other reason why desertism has fallen into disfavor, well, I hate to blame it all on such an extraordinary, wonderful, impressive person, but I think it's Rawls's fault. He did it. That is, he presented a series of arguments in A Theory of Justice in which he said desertism is false. He says it's easy to see that desertism is false. And then he gave reasons. He gave some arguments to show that desertism is false. And some of those arguments, Rawls is a wonderful guy and fabulously knowledgeable and very smart, but I think his writing style in some cases is a little bit difficult to fathom. And I think some of these arguments had never really been studied with great care, and we hadn't figured out exactly what Rawls was talking about, but they were anyway persuasive, and people moved on to different theories. I think one of these Rawlsian arguments, do we have time to talk about one of the Rawlsian arguments?
Yeah, sure. Let's do so.
One of the Rawlsian arguments, which he didn't discuss too much in A Theory of Justice, but he did discuss more in later writings, was this argument about the impractical viability of desertism as a theory of justice. And he says, it's so, you know, in a pluralistic society like what we've got here in the United States now, we've got lots of different religious traditions and we have lots of different moral views and different conceptions of human virtue. And we try to live together with these differences and we just don't agree about what would make for a really virtuous person. You know, patriotism and loyalty, for example, are good illustrations of this. Some people think that patriotism is a great virtue and other people are a little bit questionable about it. We don't know really what makes for a moral virtue. And hence, if we don't know what makes for moral virtue, if we can't agree about what makes for moral virtue, then it's going to be very hard for us to come to any agreement about what justice requires in any case, because after all, as Rawls thinks, justice is happiness in accord with virtue. That's the phrase that he uses. And so we wouldn't be able to agree what justice requires in any case because as a pluralistic society, we have different views about virtue and they're not going to be resolvable.
Right.
And I think that that really points up a difference between what Rawls was looking for. You know, Rawls says in that context, only God could make these judgments about who's virtuous, and hence only God could tell what would be a just distribution. Now, I think this points up a very interesting and important distinction between what I'm trying to do in my book, what I think that many other people who've worked on distributive justice have been trying to do, and what Rawls was trying to do in his work. I think he was trying to come up with a conception of justice that could be used in practice, maybe taught in civics classes to children, or maybe when legislators are thinking about what bill to pass, they could say, well, does this really return benefits to the morally good people or not so good people? You know, how are we going to consider that? Now, a good theory of justice on that view would be one that would be smoothly implementable in practice. I'm not looking for a view that has that feature. I'm looking for a view that has a different feature. I'm looking for a view that would be true. I'm looking for a view, maybe a little bit less pretentiously, that thoughtful people could come to accept while in reflective equilibrium. That is a view about justice which we could say the theory implies that such and such distribution would be just. And when I think about that distribution and I contemplate it, yeah, it does look just to me. And the theory says that this distribution would be unjust. And when I think about that distribution, yeah, it really would be unjust. The fact that the theory then is not smoothly implementable in practical circumstances is no mark against it. It would be a theory. Let's suppose we come up with a theory that's true. We could then agree this is the truth about distributive justice. Now, for purposes of implementation, we need to find some simple, easy-to-apply rules that will approximate the truth. I haven't been trying to do that. I haven't been trying to find simple rules. I think that the philosophical question has priority over the practical question. First, we have to figure out what justice is. Then, once we know what justice is, then we can try to find a easily implementable set of mottos that we can use to implement roughly the idea.
Well, Fred, with that, why don't we close? So thank you very much for your time today in talking about your book. And thank you, listener, for joining us for our discussion. We've been talking about Professor Fred Feldman's book. The title of the book is Distributive Justice: Getting What We Deserve from Our Country. And again, this book is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.